earlier this week, President Trump shared his thoughts about how Democrats acted during his first State of the Union address when they chose not to applaud. Here's the president.
They were like death. And un-American. Un-American. Somebody said treasonous. I mean, yeah, I guess why not? You know. Can we call that treason? Why not? I mean, they certainly didn't seem to love our country very much.
Those remarks stirred up a flurry of reaction about the use of the word treasonous. Our next guest says they fit into a rhetorical strategy that President Trump has used since the beginning of his campaign for president.
Jennifer Murcia is an associate professor in the Department of Communication at Texas A&M University and is writing a book about President Trump's rhetorical style. She's with us for a look at the tools used by the president when he speaks and the state of American political rhetoric. Jen, welcome to Central Time.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Let's start with that that moment from the president there, a pretty recent example. How does that fit into the tools you've seen the president use when he's speaking publicly?
Yeah, I've been following him pretty carefully since about December of 2015. And what I've noticed is that he uses six rhetorical strategies consistently. He did it throughout the campaign, and he does it still as president. And that's an example of paralipses. And paralipses can be said colloquially as, I'm not saying, I'm just saying. So in that case, it was, you know, I'm not saying that they are traitors or that they're treasonous, but, you know, someone said it. And why not? Why wouldn't we call him that? It's a way of saying two things at once. So you can't really hold him accountable for saying it.
And there are other examples of this where he might start something saying a lot of people are saying or something like that, something to attribute it to others and not, or say, I'm not going to say they're weak or something like that. So he could say it and not say it at the same time.
That's exactly right. And it's great because it's sort of funny when he does it. You know, you heard the audience laugh in this case. And it allows you to think that you have a kind of window into the secret inner thoughts of Donald Trump. And so it's a way of connecting with his audience. You know, he's revealing to you what he really thinks, even though he knows that he really shouldn't say what he really thinks.
And one thing I think everybody would probably agree on, like it or not, Donald Trump does not talk like your average politician. Some people have been shocked or dismayed by the way he talks. Some people love it. We've heard a lot of callers, I think at different parts of the political spectrum on this show, saying they appreciate that he doesn't have that sort of guarded, careful presidential style language. Can you talk about just the general different way of talking of Donald Trump?
Yeah, and that's definitely true. So his whole campaign was built around this idea that he wasn't going to be politically correct. He was going to tell you just what he thought, and that you knew that he was doing that because of the, you know, way that he talked to people. Some people, of course, accused him of being offensive, insulting, and I think that's probably fair. But he thought that that meant that he was honest and direct, that he wasn't beholden to special interests or lobbyists, and that he was going to solve the problems of America. And so he was able to convince his followers, I think, that the way that he talked actually signaled to them that he was a man of action and that he was going to get things done on their behalf.
I want to get into another example, another one of the rules or tools you see the president using. I learned some Latin in reading what you wrote, a technique called ad baculum. I'm going to play an example here, and then you can tell us what ad baculum is. Here's President Trump.
Hillary wants to essentially abolish the Second Amendment. By the way, and if she gets to pick her judges, nothing you can do, folks. Although the Second Amendment people, maybe there is, I don't know. But I'll tell you what, that will be a horrible day.
A lot of people drew attention to that one back during the campaign as an implied threat, and that's what ad baculum is. Tell us about that.
Absolutely. So it's a threat of force. And in the case of the example that you played, he does sort of pair it with this almost paralipses, right? This almost, you know, I wouldn't say you should do this, but maybe you would. And that's common for him, is that he will imply that maybe a threat ought to be carried out, but he won't say it in such a direct way that you could actually tell, like, and maybe hold him up in a court of law as being responsible for threatening. So he did this a lot with protesters at his rallies. You know, when a protester was being escorted out, he would say, you know, I say, don't hurt them. Don't hurt them. I always say, don't hurt them, because if I say hurt them, then I'll get into trouble. So I'm saying, don't hurt them. You know, they're nice people, whatever. And so, you know, it sounds like it could be that he wants you to hurt the protester, but you couldn't actually prove that in a court of law. So he's very tricky about the way that he uses his words.
And we've seen this a few times since he became president at press conferences. His spokesperson, often Sarah Huckabee Sanders, in clarifying, for example, the treasonous remarks, will say, well, the president was joking in this instance. And that room is left there to say that, right?
Absolutely. he leaves himself an out every time. Trump is really, really good at it. He's strategic in the way that he uses language. He's very consistent. So like I said, I noticed things that he did in December of 2015 that he kept doing throughout his campaign that he still does as president. Very consistent. But he's very strategic, and he leaves himself plausible deniability so that he can't be held accountable.
Is there a skill here? People look at President Trump speaking, especially at his rallies. These are long speeches in many cases, spontaneous in many ways, not teleprompters. A lot of those he uses them sometimes, but often not. And yet you're saying he's very consistent.
Oh, he is very consistent. So he has like set pieces, like a stand-up comedian does. If you watched a lot of his rallies, like I did for the book that I'm writing, you know, he has certain topics that he will do almost the same bit each time. Sometimes the words change a little bit. Sometimes he has them in different order. But, you know, it's the same as any other kind of politician who would do a stump speech. And Trump was doing a set piece. He just was kind of riffing off of the audience and whatnot. So it was very consistent.
We're talking to Jen Mercia, Associate Professor of Communication at Texas A&M University. She has been looking at President Trump and candidate Donald Trump's speaking style, and she saw a bunch of different tools that the president used as a candidate, uses as president. Another strategy that he uses can be heard in this bit from President Trump.
So let me ask you, because this is like, this place is packed.
Yeah.
Does everybody get this kind of a crowd?
No. No.
It's very easy. That's why he keeps calling me back.
So, Jenna, how does this fit into the tools you lay out?
Yeah, so that's a ad populum appeal, appealing to the wisdom of the crowd. And so Trump loved his rallies. He loved the energy of the rallies. He thought that his rallies were the best investment of his campaign because people had a good time. They went back and told their friends about it. And he loved the sort of energy of being around people who were applauding for him and cheering for him. And the argument by ad populum is the same thing that we saw with, you know, the way he talked about his poll numbers, you know, whenever he was doing well in the polls, or talked about crowd size at his rallies, or talked about crowd size, you know, even at the inauguration. All of those are ad populum appeals. The wisdom of the crowd. The crowd knows more than the establishment. The crowd knows more than the media. The crowd knows more than any expert. And they love Trump. Right? That was key.
And Jen, let's take a step aside from the tools you're talking about. Another question you explore is President Trump a demagogue? First of all, what is a demagogue, and how do we apply that term to a modern American politician?
Yeah, it's such an interesting question to me, and this is the focus of my book. If you look up the word demagogue in the Oxford English Dictionary, the OED, you actually get two absolutely contradictory definitions. The first one is that a demagogue is the leader of the people who defends the interests of the people against the other parts of the state, the other corrupt parts of the state. The second definition is a political leader who uses polarizing language to divide the people for their own gain. So Donald Trump ran His whole campaign was premised on demagoguery. He ran as a demagogue in the good sense of the word, right? And his followers believe, still today, I believe, that that he was and is a demagogue in the good sense, that he is a popular leader that emerges, you know, sort of somewhat from the people. He speaks their language, and that he is defending their interests against the other parts of the state, the political parties, the media, who are corrupt. Other people, of course, see him as a polarizing figure and as a demagogue in the negative sense of the word. So in my book, I'm trying to sort of explain how he could be both of those things at the same time, and how he used demagogic rhetorical appeals in the negative sense to prevent himself from being held accountable for his actions.
Jen Murcia is with us, associate professor in the Department of Communication at Texas A&M University. We're talking about President Trump's rhetorical style.
800-642-1234 is the number to call to join our conversation. What do you like or not like about President Trump's rhetorical style? Do you think his methods are changing American political rhetoric? Do you think political rhetoric is improving or getting harsher? You can also email your thoughts to ideas@WPR.org, or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. Jen, before we get back to some of the tools you list out, we've been talking about whether the president is changing American political rhetoric, the way politicians talk. Could someone else do what he does?
I think it would be very difficult for someone else to do it. And we've seen some people try. So during the campaign, if you remember, Rubio tried to use some of the ad hominem tactics against Trump, tried to attack him personally instead of attacking his arguments. And it didn't play out very well for him. So when he attacked Trump for having small hands, Rubio came out looking badly. And I think we've seen, you know, some Democrats try to use like intense language, swear words, and that rings very false. I think that Trump has built up a kind of immunity for himself. And so he is immune from criticism for saying a lot of things, but other people probably wouldn't be. So I don't think that we're going to see, you know, an avalanche of Trumps out there. I don't think it's possible.
You mentioned the ad hominem attack. That's another one of the tools you write about. Here's an example. The president talking here about rival Republican presidential candidate John Kasich and his eating habits.
He has a news conference all the time when he's eating. I have never seen a human being eat in such a disgusting fashion.
A lot of comments like this. We played the president talking about Mitt Romney walking like a penguin at one point. Talk about this as a rhetorical tool.
Yeah, so it's a polarizing strategy. He is pointing his finger at his opponents and inviting us to ridicule them. So ridicule Kasich for the way that he eats, ridicule Romney for the way that he walks, ridicule Jeb Bush for being low energy. Those are, you know, us versus them strategies. And so instead of dealing with their policies or their policy criticisms that they might have about Trump, instead of doing that, he goes for ad hominem attacks, which are absolutely about pitting, you know, us, the good guys, versus them, the bad guys. They're polarizing strategies.
Let's go to our callers now. We have Kelly on the line in Cascade. Kelly, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What did you want to bring up?
I just have a very visceral response to Trump. I mean, ever since he was on the campaign trail, it's just been very hard for me to even hear what he has to say. All I can hear is the energy and the polarization efforts. I just feel like it's somehow it always seems to point back to him being this wonderful, amazing person that we should all bow down to. And it rubs against everything that I feel our country stands for and that I would want in a leader.
Kelly, thanks so much for your call. And Jen, she said a visceral reaction. I bet you could see that word applied to people who hate the way the president talks and love the way he talks.
Yeah, absolutely. The people who go to his rallies, you know, you can see them just enjoying it. He is a very polarizing figure, and he does inspire great affection and enthusiasm from the people who see him as a demagogue in the good sense. They see him defending their interests. Likewise, just like Kelly, there's a great big segment of the population that sees him in a really negative way and has that visceral negative response. That is Trump. He is just a polarizing figure. And I think that he invites that kind of polarization through the way that he talks. I mean, he really is trying to divide the country into us versus them.
Kelly, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Deanne in Eau Claire. Deanne, hi.
Hi. I guess my comment is that I feel that, you know, our intellects on both sides here are giving Donald Trump too much credit. I don't believe that he actually has a style per se. I think, you know, he's just simply a bully. And like a lot of bullies, he's all over the place and serving his purpose. I have never seen Donald Trump in all of the years that I've watched him. I mean, he's 20 years older than me, but he's been in the news my adult life. I've never seen him as anybody that had, you know, an intelligent opinion, highly educated.
Deanne, thanks for the call. What do you think, John?
Yeah, I think that you're right that he is a bully. And I guess the question is whether you think he's a bully for the right reasons or the wrong reasons. So his followers certainly see that him as a bully for the right reasons, not so much his detractors. You know, it's hard to judge his intellect. He will certainly tell you that he's among the smartest or the greatest or went to the best schools with the best words. And that's, you know, something that he'll tell you consistently. But what I've noticed in following him and watching all of his rallies and all of that for years now is that he is incredibly consistent. And part of it is that he's an incredibly consistent bully. So he uses the ad baculum threats. He uses the ad hominem attacks. He uses the paralipses so he can't be held accountable. He does all these things very strategically. I've been trying to, I think, coin a word because I've looked it up and it doesn't seem to be a word. But he's, to me, he's aethical, meaning that he doesn't consider ethics in how he talks. He considers strategy, trying to get his goal and what he can say to achieve those goals. And so I think that, you know, people like Kelly and Deanne might say that Trump is unethical in the way that he talks. I might also say that, but I don't think that he considers ethics. So I think that he's aethical, if that were a word.
Thanks for the call, Deanne. We're talking to Jen Merchia about President Trump's rhetorical strategies, the way he talks in his rallies and elsewhere. Back to your calls now. Anita is with us in Bessemer, Michigan. Anita, hi.
Hi. Really an interesting show. I'm listening to your guest. And I'm a dictionary. I always look up stuff in the dictionary. And demagogue comes from a Greek word meaning demos, the people, and the other part, agigas, meaning leader, one who tries to stir up people's emotions so as to gain power. So I found that very interesting.
Anita, thanks. Another definition than the OED you mentioned, but along the same lines, Jen.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's such an interesting word for me. I started studying demagoguery about 10 years ago, well before I became interested in Donald Trump. And my interest was largely in that contradictory way that we think about the word when we look it up in the dictionary versus the always negative way that we talk about a demagogue. And it's interesting to me because, I mean, a leader of the people, as she said, as Anita said, you know, that's the etymology of the word. And wouldn't we want someone to emerge from the people to lead the people? We would. So why is a demagogue a negative thing is how I sort of got interested originally in it, because I like word meaning too, Anita. And then got more interested in their techniques and strategies.
And Jen, what are you watching for as the Trump presidency goes on, just briefly as we wrap up?
Well, I'm interested to see if he ever allows himself to be held accountable. That, to me, is sort of the defining feature of the demagogue in the negative sense. So we wouldn't want a leader who's unaccountable, who you can't, you know, rein in. That's why we have a system of checks and balances. That's why we are fearful of demagogues, you know, when we're fearful of them. And so my interest in watching him is to see if somebody can finally control him and how that plays out, because he's been very crafty so far.
Jen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
That's Jen Mercia, associate professor in the Department of Communication at Texas A&M University. She's working on a book about President Trump's rhetorical style.
Coming up Monday on Central Time, we'll check out a new plan from UW-Madison to provide free tuition for students from families making less than $56,000 a year.
Most economic growth in the United States is happening in larger urban areas, but a guest says policymakers should not give up on smaller cities and rural areas.
And Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine is back with us for a look at some of the most intriguing stories from the worlds of science.
That and look at some of the top news stories of the day. It's all coming up Monday here on Central Time.